Hello, everybody. Spencer here from Constructor Criticism. So, after a little bit of editing, I realized that I couldn't save what is an amazing show by Mason and Michael. There was just some audio issues that I couldn't fix. So, instead of, like, trying to make this jumbled mess, I decided to just give this episode out a little bit raw. There's some audio issues, but the content is really great. Mason and Michael did a great job. And I just want to give them a super shout out for an amazing show. We'll fix the audio issues in the future. I really hope you guys can enjoy the episode. And thank you so much to them. They did an amazing job this week. So enjoy the episode, and we'll see you guys all next week.
I'm your guest host, Mason, and I'm joined this week by our very own Silver Pro, Michael Hinderacher. Michael, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good, Mason.
Yeah. Did you have a fun
Such a week? Nice intro.
Oh, thank you.
Such a nice intro.
No, not every time we need to build each other up or tear each other down. We can just be true to each other. You know, game day champion, Mason Clark, Silver Pro, Michael Hinderacher. We know our roles, you know?
Not as dissimilar as you'd think.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Top 19 RPTQ competitor, you know, graduating class of 2021. We'll get to that later, though. But you know what we'll always get to you first thing? Oasis Games, proud sponsor, Constructor Criticism. You can go to Oasis Games and find all the cards you're looking for. You know, sometimes you go to other sites and you can't exactly find weird cards you're looking for, like Call the Netherworld or Big Game Hunter, just to name two that maybe I needed. But I went to Oasis, I found the cards, they got shipped to me right away, and at a good price too. And it's nice, you can use the code hashtag would that be good for 4% back in store credit. I believe I did that right.
I think it's just would that be good is 4% back in store credit, and I'm pretty sure that the code CCMTG, like the letter C, letter C, letter M, letter T, letter G, should be 15% off your first order. So if you haven't used that, go ahead and take advantage of it. Buy yourself some sweet stuff.
Yeah, buy yourself some Hollow Boys.
I mean, you could. You certainly could.
Well, there's nowhere else. There's like no better deck in Modern except maybe Humans. And if you want to check out those two decks, you can go to our other sponsor, the Mana Base. They have lots of content for Unbecoming Magic players, including, I believe I saw a video on there the other day for Hollow One, and I'm pretty sure they have stuff for Humans too. When I was there the other day, or a little bit while back. So you can find stuff on the two best decks in Modern right now, Hollow Boys and Humans. They're a great sponsor, and sometimes, you know, they support Morphwork players, which is just a good charity thing to do, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's truly just some good people over there.
Yeah, give back to those who really need it. So, speaking of giving back to those who really need it, if you become a patron of the show, we thank you, and we give you like to give a shout out to all new patrons. So, Dawson C, thank you for pledging. And then let's move on to our Patreon question, Michael. So, if you're a patron, you can ask us questions, and we'll answer on the show. You want to go ahead and read that for us?
Yeah. Jonathan asks, in standard Grixis Energy, how do you feel about 4 Rekindling Phoenix and 4 Glorybringer? These would take the place of other creatures, removal, counter spells, and search for Iskanta. So that was something I messed around with a little bit, before discovering that none of these decks really beat God Pharaoh's Gift. If Mono Red is less, I think that, like, this would make sense as a metagame call against Sultai, but I think that we've maybe seen that there are stronger metagame calls against Sultai, like, mm-hmm. with our GP results this weekend. But I don't think it's a terrible idea right now. I think the Monsters deck was at least sort of well-positioned this last weekend, largely because of its Sultai matchup.
Yeah, I agree. I had a friend do pretty well at a PPTQ a week or two ago, playing those instead of the stuff he talks about. And I think, and our area doesn't have a lot of mono-red at that time. I don't know about nowadays, but now that I'm done queuing for him. But I know that it was good against all those other decks they talk about, like Snake and stuff like that, so I agree. If you're trying to beat those kind of decks, that's definitely a change that I would look into making.
Yeah, at least something to consider.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's always good to go back and revisit stuff. You know, we talked about how, like, that's something sure. Michael used to do before. It's like, well, maybe the format's, you know, rotating up to come back. So, you know, just a good...
Yeah, I think just sort of doing your due diligence in general is really important. Just kind of grinding through every iteration that you're interested in. You can't really know for sure until you try it.
Definitely. I agree. So let's move on to hashtag always improving, Michael. Hashtag always improving is the point of the show. You know, if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. And you played a GP this weekend, Michael. So what was your hashtag always improving moment?
I just had a really good time. I got to hang out with my brother. I hung out with Matt and Alex and Danny, and I got to meet Jerry Thompson and got to talk to Corey Burkhardt a little bit, and like, my result wasn't that good. I think I went 9-2 to 9-5 drop, but I had a good weekend.
You only played standard, right?
Yeah. I was really confident in our standard deck. I don't love where Legacy is right now, so just standard, but I had a really enjoyable weekend, and I think that separating my happiness from the result, it felt really good.
Awesome, I'm glad to hear that. Well, I had a RPTQ this weekend, so it was interesting. It was, if you've been playing the RPTQs, you know it's been Rivals of Ixalan sealed for this one, and then draft, you make it to top four. I'm sorry, top eight. I didn't have an amazing pool. I thought it was pretty average. All my friends thought it was really bad. And they all think I got to basically the same deck they would have, maybe minus a card or two. So I'm happy to have that. Sealed is something where I always feel like I never build the best deck out of my pool. I always build a deck that's kind of like average for my pool, if that makes sense. You get what I'm feeling there, Michael?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, for better or worse, you have a lot of choices in Sealed. And a lot of it comes down, like, you're not usually going to miss a deck that's, like, dramatically better than what you register.
Yeah.
If you've just played much of the limited format, that doesn't usually happen to you. But sometimes you can, like, maybe your preference, like, you over or undervalue some of the commons in the format, and as a result play a deck that's a little suboptimal.
Yeah, definitely. I would say I'm pretty classic at doing that.
Yeah, I think that's hard to avoid. I mean, I think that expecting perfection is mostly going to leave you unhappy.
But that brings me to my second part of my always improving moment, Michael, with my perfect record at game day with the Event Challenger deck. It was just fun to like play a tournament just for fun and like kind of challenge myself playing a deck that isn't very good in the Mardu event. I mean, the event decks are good, but you know what I mean? Like a Mardu event isn't exactly something you'd want to play at a normal tournament. I never would. But it was nice to like play like a... an experience like what a new player would experience, like if you were getting into it. So
yeah, it sounds like a good time, and I think just making sure that in general you're enjoying what you're doing is really important.
Yeah, definitely agree.
Like, you know, it's something we mostly do for fun, and if it's not fun, kind of what's the point?
Exactly. Broadening your horizons, always do new
things. I got to meet Jared this weekend, as well as a couple of other people who listen to the podcast, and it was really nice. I had really good experiences with everyone I ran into, so it was a good time.
Awesome. Shout out to you all. I know Jared, he says mean things to me on Twitter about how I look very young. Quite rude, but I'm sure he's a nice guy. Normally, this would be we do the Patreon Deck Doctor. We did not have a Deck Doctor submitted this week, but if you're a patron and you have a deck you want us to talk about, maybe a modern deck, something like that, or maybe a new
brew, yep.
Dominaria, shoot on over on the Patreon, and we'll be glad to talk about it in the future. Especially, I mean, there's some new exciting cards, Michael.
Always happy to provide feedback, and always happy when people are interested in what I have to say. That's fun, and it's flattering.
Okay, definitely. Well, let's move on to Card of the Week, but before we do that, we have to announce our winner for the last batch of Card of the Week, which our winner is, drumroll please, Kyle Norman. So Kyle, Spencer's going to get in contact with you very soon about shipping you the following cards. Kyle won the Scarab God, Hadana's Climb, Kite Self Rebooter, and Delver of Secrets. So, exciting cards to win. Kind of an all-star in a couple different formats there, so.
Yeah, those are some pretty sweet ones. I don't know the quantities on all of them, but they're certainly powerful.
Definitely. But let's move on to this week's Card of the Week, Michael, and I think you can talk about this one quite a lot. We're going to do God Pharaoh's Gift. So I think we're going to give away a couple of these to whichever listener wins at the end of the next month. Let's talk about God Pharaoh's Gift, though, Michael. What makes this the Card of the Week?
All right, so this was like the leveling the mid-range heavy metagame, basically. Where it is like people are settling into all these decks with a lot of removal spells that are good against mono-red and just trying to grind each other out. God Pharaoh's Gift goes way over the top of that. Blue-Red Gift, I would imagine, had the best win percentage of any deck. It put 3 in the top 8, I think 2 or 3 more in the top 16. It was pretty great. Even Blue-White God Pharaoh's Gift saw a little bit of success, although it was markedly worse. Card's just really powerful. It this kind of card where basically when you end up with it in play, your opponent will lose the game in the next 2 to 3 turns almost no matter what.
Yeah, it's very, very powerful. So where does this card fit into the format? You're talking about how it beats the mid-range decks. Is it helpful that, like, you know, despite what won the tournament, red was kind of, you know, not a deck that people were really looking at before with the downtick in the Braids? Is the blue-red God Fairy Gift really care about the Braids? You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it still does. Like, it's a metagame call. I certainly don't think this deck is, like, oppressive and necessarily the deck to beat going forward. I don't think the deck is especially good against mono-red, but all of your other matchups are pretty fantastic, so it just kind of... It both control and mid-range decks that play a Braid but don't clock you especially quickly, you don't care about at all. It's a combination of a Braid and, you know, Hazorettes and all that stuff that can make it rough.
Awesome. Well, at the end of the month, just like we do every month, we're going to give out a Godfarer's Gift along with 3 other cards to one of our lucky patrons. So if you want to join in that, I believe you have to be a patron of $3 or more. So if you're one, feel free to hop in that. But let's move on to our power rankings. So each week we like to talk about a format and kind of talk about what's been going on in that format with the results in the last week. And this week we have Standard. So this is exciting, Michael. We're going to have 5 really different decks that I think what people would have expected and kind of even what we talked about last week on Constructed Criticism with you gone. But let's hop into our 5th place deck here, which is Mardu Vehicles.
Yeah, so Mardu saw a little bit of a resurgence. I think Walking Ballista is both heavily played and very good right now, and this is one of the best Walking Ballista decks. I think, like, in combination with a Braid and Unlicensed Disintegration, both kind of seeing maybe a little bit of an uptick due to the prevalence of Sultai. I think this deck being able to play both and Walking Ballista just gave it pretty good overall game. I think in general the mana is still pretty bad, and I don't know that it is, like, a great choice going forward, but I was happy to see this do well once again.
Yeah, the deck has some really powerful cards in it and some really powerful draws. I wonder, does this deck get any big upgrades from Dominaria? Like, in the mana base, do you think it would be noticeably better now that we have the new fast lands? Or the check lands, I mean, sorry.
It's possible. The check lands were a little bit awkward just because of how many fast lands this deck wants to run. Mm-hmm. So the check lands have always been a little bit underwhelming. I think that we might see things shift more towards, like, the red-black aggro style that we'll talk about in the next couple of minutes.
Definitely, I agree. Yeah, it's cool to see more vehicles, though, but let's move right on to the next deck, and this is one we've talked about a little bit these last couple of weeks. We even had Jay Dean come on, which is Sultai Constrictor. So this is a deck that I really like, and I think, you know, up until this weekend was very well positioned in the metagame. Michael, what do you think about this list that we have on screen here, the top 8 in?
So this is the list by Slater, yes?
Yes, sir.
So I think that this was sort of the deck to beat coming into the weekend, and I like some of the concessions that Slater specifically made. I think playing no double green 3-drops in the main deck improves your mana substantially. That being said, I think this deck underperformed as a whole over the weekend. It was, from what I saw, easily the most played deck. Mm-hmm. And did not do particularly well.
Yeah, it really... I wonder, and we might talk about this more when we get to our number one deck, you know, which if you watch the Grand Prix is no surprise going to be Gift. But this deck is so powerful that, I don't know, going into it, there was a lot of talk about, like, Blue-Black and Scarab God and Snake. Like, Blue-Black with Scarab God and Snake, like, as the big decks to beat. And, I don't know, it just didn't really live up to the hype, kind of. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that this deck in particular has kind of a sketchy mono-red matchup in addition to being pretty terrible against the Gift decks.
Yeah.
And I think that combination, it just plays a lot of tap lands, and sometimes you'll lose to mono-red just by getting kind of tempoed out of the game, especially on the draw. And I think that in combination with a pretty bad Gift matchup held it back a lot this weekend.
Yeah, and it's weird, too, because I agree with Jardine when she was on, I think, 3 weeks ago, and she talked about how you can really beat almost any deck if you only had a metagame for those decks with this one. But mono-red, even when I try, it's still really hard. Like, I was playing a third cartouche in my sideboard, and it still wasn't easy.
Yeah, she talked about the mana being pretty abysmal too, and I think one of the problems with this deck in general is that the mana sort of informs the choices you're really allowed to make in the main deck. Mm-hmm. Like, Slater is playing a more conservative mana base and then playing Extrovert Riskier Hulk, so I'm pretty sure that his list is actually a list that comes from, what's his name? Nathan Stoyer.
Okay, I don't think I've seen his version of it.
But. Okay. He is a little bit younger, but very prolific Magic Online player. But I think that basically, like, you would rather play Thrashing Brontodon in the main in a lot of matchups, but it's really hard to play double green 3-drops in this deck.
Yeah.
It's really, like, your mana base is just so demanding between Fatal Push, Blossoming Defense, and then Hedonna's Climb is really secretly a double blue card a lot of the time. Right, in that you often want to play and activate it on the same turn. So, I think the mana in this deck is just, like, problematically bad, and when you find yourself having to play worse cards to make your mana okay, you just are making concessions somewhere, right? Either you're losing some percentage against the field because your mana will not cooperate some percentage of the time, or you are instead going to play kind of mediocre cards like Rishkar in the main deck and only side in Thrashing Brontodon when it's great, which makes sense, but it kind of double costs you sideboard slots, right? Like, if you were playing Thrashing Brontodon in the main, you could side in Deathgorge Scavengers or more. Like, you would have 3 more sideboard slots to work with, so it's a little tricky.
Yeah, it's definitely some give and take there. Do you find it, when you're looking at a deck for, like, you know, going into this GP weekend, was Sultai Constrictor kind of rolled out for you because of how bad the mana is? Because, I mean, the mana is really bad with the deck.
I think you just, like, you have to play some games and kind of get a feel for it, but mm-hmm. It's not, my preference is not to play this style of deck in general anyways, so, like, I'm probably a little biased against it on the whole, and yes, the mana was atrocious, and yes, that did push me away from it.
Right, that's fair. Because yeah, I know you used to play Mardu Vehicles a fair bit, but I mean, that deck was also insane back then. But
that deck used to have much better mana, too, for what it's worth.
Yeah, the mana now is somehow worse. In a deck that's biggest complaint before was the mana was bad. But moving on, let's go to Mono Red. So this is the list up on screen that had a historic moment, in case you didn't know. The guy who played this deck, whose name I can't read on my overlay here, he went 18-0 at the GP, Michael.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah. Do you think that's, like, above average, D's plus?
At least,
yeah. So, Mono Red is a deck that, you know, Spencer was really high on, and I'm sure he would love to be here to talk about. Unfortunately, he's on a business trip for work. But what do you think about Mono Red, Michael? What do you think about the deck list choices that he made here?
I think it ended up being a good call for the weekend. I think that, like, 4 Rekindling Phoenix was probably pretty good in the Sultai matchup. And I imagine that, like, between those and the Glorybringers in the sideboard, he was trying to give himself more of, like, a green-red monster's feel against Sultai. One of the ways you can try to beat Sultai is by siding into a ton of removal spells and bigger creatures to try to really make Cartouche of Ambition less potent against you. So I think his list is, like, pretty well thought out. I'm quite confident that 3 Scavenger Grounds was, that seems like a lot, but it was almost certainly the right number for this weekend. Mm-hmm. And I think just being heavy on 4-drops in general makes you a little more resilient to, like, the kinds of things that people usually are trying to do against Mono Red.
Definitely agree.
Like, just playing a slightly larger Mono Red deck, I think, was probably a good choice.
Now, I forget the name of the card. I don't think he played in his deck, but the desert that you sack it to put -1/-1 on a creature?
He did play those, playing... Okay. His deserts are Grasping Dunes and Scavenger Grounds, and one of the nice things is that as you move away from 1-drops a little bit, you're less... Like, he's only playing 8 1-drops and only 6 2-drop creatures, I believe. When you move away from, like, the super heavy 1-drop package, where... Like, a lot of the lists are playing, you know, up to... I saw lists with as many as 12 1-drops, and it's more often 7 or 8 2-drop creatures. When you play lists that are playing more of those and less for Kindling Phoenixes, because this guy's playing the full four in the main deck, I think you are more incentivized to play cards like Sunscorched Desert. Okay. And Sunscorched Desert is really not good.
Yeah, it's not a very exciting card.
It's super low impact unless it deals exactly the last point. So if you build a deck that is very good at dealing tons of damage early and then is going to struggle to close games, you're kind of priced into playing them. But in this style, I think he's more concerned about winning Rekindling Phoenix Mirrors.
Yeah.
And I think that shows in his deck building decisions.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And I do want to say that Rekindling Phoenix is one of the most annoying cards when you're playing Snake. It's so good at stopping your strategy. So if you're playing Snake, that's a good card.
It's a big blocker, it's a flying attacker, it almost requires a Walking Ballista to answer.
Yeah, I would say it does require one.
Contempt can get it sometimes, but sure, it's awkward.
Contempt gets everything. Let's move on to Black-Red Aggro, because I think... So we could have put these as the same deck, but I feel like they are different enough that they deserve to be different spots. So Black-Red Aggro is a deck that has been popping up a decent amount of Magic Online. The list we have up on the screen is Jerry Thompson's third/fourth place finish. What do you think about this style of deck compared to Mono Red, Michael?
So I think this deck is much closer to Mardu Vehicles. It's just built a lot more kind of defensively and grindy than the Mono Red decks are. It's like playing a bunch of...
Too.
Yeah, like, this to me more replaces the Mardu deck with the main thought process then being you have to play either Sphere Harvesters instead of Heart of Cairns. But I don't know that that's a huge downside.
Yeah, it could be an upside in a lot of matchups.
Yeah, it certainly can be. But I like that this deck has the ability to stay relatively aggressive, or it can become like much bigger in sideboarding. I think it has a lot of flexible cards. You get to play Abrades that are really good because a lot of your ways to finish games are pretty durable in like Hazoret, Rekindling Phoenix, Glorybringer, Scrap Heap Scrounger, Chandra, Aethersphere Harvesters. So I think you feel the there's less pull to play something like Lightning Strike in this deck. And I think that Abrade was much more powerful this weekend on the whole.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think this is the deck I'm most... You know, the next deck we're going to talk about in Blue-Red Gift is exciting, but this is the one I'm actually the most excited to like play a league with. Is this thing that you think... I mean, this format's, you know, sort of a lame duck. There's only like one or two more weekends left for people to play PBDQs with it. But if you were going to play one, is this one that you would like maybe spend some more time on, or did you look at this deck already going into the GP?
I looked at it a little bit, and I do really like it. You get, like... I like that Jerry's playing extra land in the sideboard, along with a few more kind of big threats. So you can either side down a little bit and bring in, like, be like a control deck with, like, Fatal Push and Sweltering Suns. Or you can kind of side up and cut some of your dead removal for more big threats, more lands, and, like, Bloodfasts and Doomfalls. So, in general, I really like decks that can kind of go both ways. They're just hard to sideboard against. And they give... They give you as a good player a lot of flexibility in what your game plans are in different matchups in boarded games. And I think that that's worth a lot, especially if you're a great player like Jerry.
Yeah, I super agree. That's some really leverageable skill. I think it was kind of on me in an improving moment here when you're like, yeah, this deck really is just like a better Mardu vehicle. It's like we talked about how the mana wasn't very good. This mana seems pretty good. And you get to play cards like Argol's Bloodfast and go bigger like Mardu did, what was it, like two formats ago now? So...
Yeah, you still have a lot of the same appeals. I think Heart of Cairn is probably less good now than it has been in the past. I think vehicles in general are just less good, and this is more of a deck that upgrades its Thopter to an Aethersphere Harvester and plays Aethersphere Harvester defensively to help protect its Chandras, that kind of stuff, than it is a deck that's like really like a curve-out beatdown deck.
Okay. One last question before we move on. What do you think about Nerdape?
I think that it just, like, it blocking Bomat Courier and being generally both a relevant attacker and blocker was pretty good this weekend. I don't think it's, like, an outstanding card in general, but it's the kind of card that can get a lot of chip damage early in a deck with a lot of reach with, like, Unlicensed Chandra, Glorybringer, and can also Stonewall aggro decks a little bit, which I think you need when you're playing, like, Scrap Heap Scroungers and stuff like that. Because I would imagine Mono Red can be a little tricky sometimes.
Yeah. It's almost like your Toolcraft Exemplar, but fits your style of deck better.
Yeah, if you're not trying to crew three drops, it fills that same role, right? Or if you're not trying to crew Heart of Kirin, rather. You're trying to crew three drops, you're not trying to crew three power crew things. Yet.
Yeah. I think we all got you from here. So, speaking of getting what you all meant here, Michael, this is the deck you play at the GP. It's our number one deck on the power rankings here in Blue-Red God Pharaoh's Gift, and it's also our deck of the week. So we're going to go a little bit deeper on this one. Let's just kind of talk about... Well, do you want to read the deck list first for those that maybe haven't seen it, and then we'll kind of delve into it?
So I'm going to read the main deck of the deck that I played this weekend and that Corey finished 13th with, because I'm about 100% sure our main deck and 85% of the sideboard is just better.
I like it. I'm ready to talk about that too, so let's hear it.
Okay, so it's 4 Walking Ballista, 4 Beaumont Courier, 4 Fanatical Firebrand, 4 Minister of Inquiries, 4 Warcry Marauder, 4 Champion of Wits, 4 Combat Celebrants, 2 Trophy Mage, and 2 Glint Nest Cranes, where most people are playing Vizier Many Faces.
Yep.
You have 4 Gate to the Afterlife and 2 God Pharaoh's Gift, and then 22 lands, 4 Islands, 6 Mountain, 4 Blue-Red Fastlands, 4 Ipnu Rivulets, and 4 Aether Hubs.
Okay.
As far as sideboard... that we were doing differently. We sideboarded Hazoret, which was generally insane. I wish we would have played some of Braids in the sideboard, but we did not.
What about Hazoret was so insane? Just like
so
great card or what?
It beats green red monsters single handedly. That matchup is really bad otherwise, and if you're playing Hazoret, you almost cannot lose a boarded game where you draw Hazoret.
Okay. Sure, that makes
sense. They just can't beat that card.
So when it comes to the main deck, what do you like so much better about your sideboard than this one? Because, I mean, you took a very, you know, confident stand on it. So what do you like better about yours?
You basically never need the Viziers. The Viziers are cute, and it's nice that you can... Like, think about what has to happen for a Vizier to actually be good. So it's not a very good card to hard cast, like, 99% of the time, right?
Yep, agreed.
It's a card that its best mode by far is embalming it after you discard it with a Champion of Wits.
Yeah,
it's not really good with God Pharaoh's Gift because your Combat Celebrant has to both attack and live because you can't reanimate a second creature until after your first combat.
Yep.
And if your first Combat Celebrant is attacking and living,
you're winning.
It's so rare that you actually need to like full combo your opponent.
I got you. So your deck's doesn't have the I win button as hard, but when those kind of things are going off, you don't really need them.
Right. I mean, 99% of the time, the hard part is finding your pieces, and Glint Nest Crane is very good at that. It's also pretty good against mono red. It just blocks.
Mm-hmm.
It's another 2-drop in a deck with a pretty bad curve.
Yeah.
Compared to Vizier, which is actually making your already bad curve even worse.
Makes a lot of sense. You have a lot of hits, too, with Glint Nest Crane. You have, like...
What, yeah.
No,
14. It's 14, but the gifts only count if you can then find a champion. So it's, like, 12, but, you know, 4 chances to hit 12.
Not bad.
It's not terrible. It's, like... I mean, I guess it's 0.75 to the 4th, roughly.
40 chess
going. So... you are about 30% to miss. The flip side is that you are, you know, if 3 of those hits are Gate to the Afterlife, you're about, what, then almost 25% to hit a gate. And Walking Ballista is similarly frequently a great hit. Beaumont Courier often comes out the same turn as well, so it still provides a blocker or an attacker, depending on what you need. I think Crane... just shores up a lot of it. It's like halfway between another creature and like playing like Cathartic Reunion.
Yeah, I really like it now that you're mentioning it. It also helps. Do you guys have the Silent Gravestone in your sideboard as well?
Yes.
Even
so
post board, it makes it even better.
Yep, exactly. I think it's just a really solid card. It's not perfect, but hitting 7 out of 10 times is pretty good given that the 1/3 body is also totally fine.
Gotcha. So what got you to this deck, and what made it, you know, it crushed the GP? Do you want to kind of talk about why it's so good in the metagame?
Yeah, it just mauls the mid-range decks. You're very good at, like, attacking for, you know, 60 on
casual
turn 5, while having blockers in play the whole game, while having Warkite Marauder in play. I mean, I beat a bunch of Thrashing Brontodons with Warkite Marauder. I killed a Hazoret with a Warkite Marauder on feature against Jerry.
I didn't know you had a feature match.
Yeah, you can go watch game 2 and 3 if you're curious. It's somewhere in there. I don't know exactly where. It would have been round 12, I think.
Okay. So I have a question about Warkite Marauder.
Yes.
How does that work with Scarab God again? It makes
it does not come back. It's okay. 0/1 that does not come back. Same with Rekindling Phoenix.
Oh, I thought it's
so. It slaughters both of those cards.
That's savage, Michael.
Jeez. Yeah, one of the best sequences you can have is just like turn 2 Warkite Marauder, turn 3 anything, turn 4 attack, Walking Ballista for 2, ping what I wanted to die, still have the same amount of creatures. One of the key things, like as far as playing the deck, things to remember, you can cast Walking Ballista for 0, which you do a lot. You can also use Walking Ballista or Fanatical Firebrand to shoot another of your 1 toughness creatures to get 2 triggers that way.
Yeah,
you can use Beaumont Courier as like a 2 mana discard your hand.
Really powerful.
If it, so it sounds bad, except that sometimes it means your opponent is dead right now, like on turn 4. Like there were a number of times. Yeah.
If you're trying to sell someone a card, it's like, yeah, for 2 mana you get to discard your whole hand.
Well, the secret is that sometimes for 2 mana you get to put, you know, triple combat celebrant in your graveyard and then you attack your opponent 4 times or whatever and they die. When you side in the Hazorets, the Walking Ballistas are also insane, because even if your opponent has seen the Hazoret, they'll often try to, like, attack you in a way and they'll be like, how many cards do you have in your hand? And you can play Hazoret Walking Ballista for 0.
Oh, get him.
Yeah, so there are some really cool interactions with Walking Ballista in this deck. It's really powerful. The Warkite Marauders are pretty sweet too.
So you said this deck is a metagame deck, and you don't think it's broke or anything like that. Is this a deck we should be keeping our eye on going into Dominaria? Do you think, or do you think it's one of those things that like you need to keep in your back pocket if we get back to where we were before?
It's hard to say. I mean, it's definitely powerful. I had a bunch of turn 4 kills. I mean, I had some turn 4 kills without even a combo. I had like a game where I just went like 1-drop, 2-drop, combat celebrant, Hazoret, attack, exert, attack.
Jeez.
You know, which is like pretty powerful. So you can definitely do some like really broken things with this deck.
Yeah, and that's something that you don't get out of the like the blue white or the Esper Godfarer Gift decks, which the Esper one's kind of not really a thing anymore, but it was for a little while.
Yeah, this deck is way better than the blue white deck. I don't think it's close to being close. Just way more explosive. And like you actually can win on a backup plan. Like casting Angel of Invention is just not a real backup plan, but Warkite Marauder plus literally anything is a really good backup plan. I mean, think of it this way, right? Anytime your opponent plays a creature and you have a Warkite Marauder in play, you basically get to disallow their creature for free.
That's very true.
Right? It's just like, well, this isn't really, it's only a creature when you're attacking.
Yeah, and your deck likes erase a lot, so that's not...
Right, and you're playing 12 1-drops and, like, you know, often siding in Hazorets in the matchups where they're likely to have hate, so you can do kind of a weird mono-red impression, but Warkite Marauder is really, really sweet.
Awesome. That's really cool to hear. So before we move on from this, I do want to mention there were 0 Scarab Gods in our top 5 deck lists. What do you think about that, Michael?
I think we've just seen a lot of decks rise up that are good against Scarab God. The blue-red deck in particular almost can't lose to any of the like blue-black or Grixis midrange. I mean, the only one of those decks in the top 16 was played by Brad Nelson. I think that tells you a lot about, you know, how good a choice those really were for this weekend. I think that, like, the mono-red deck is... I think that the Sultai deck really has a very good Grixis and blue-black matchup. And that was out in such force that it really pushed those decks away from doing well. And then a lot of what did well were the decks that were really good against Sultai.
Yeah, I agree. That makes a lot of sense. That, like, everything you said, it sounds... When you're describing this deck, it does seem miserable to be playing Grixis or...
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty bad for Sultai, too. You can definitely win sometimes, but you're almost trying to, like, combo against a deck that's just better at comboing. right? Like, if the Sultai deck is forced into playing a control role and, like, trying to hold up Thrashing, like, draw and hold up Thrashing Brontodon, and then you have to kill every Warkite Marauder, and, you know, you have to, like, it's just awkward. It's really tough for the Sultai deck to win games that look like that. It's not quite as... So, most of the times when Sultai wins, it's, like, maybe one piece of quick interaction into... Or even none, and just, like, Servant, Hydra, Climb, Constrictor kill you.
Yeah.
Which can happen, but it's not most games.
Yeah, I wouldn't bet the Family Farm on it.
Right. All right,
well, that is our power rankings for the week. Thank you so much, Michael, for talking about Blue-Red Godfarer Gift. That's a deck where if you weren't here, I just don't know what I would say, because I have never played with or against this deck, because I have been focusing more on Modern and Limited the last couple weeks.
So. Yeah, it's a deck that kind of came out of nowhere, but it was a good choice for this tournament. Extremely powerful, and kind of a good time, you know? Mm-hmm. It's fun when you get to brown people with Bolt Mythics.
Yeah, I like it. Bolt Mythics are the best cards to win with.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of winning, Michael, let's move straight into our training grounds for the week. So, this week's training grounds is how to win a PPTQ Part 1. We're going to focus on preparation. So, Michael, what do we mean when we're talking about preparation for a PPTQ?
I guess preparation to me is, like, making sure... This comes back to probably... basically everything I ever say, but, like, just making sure I'm doing things with a reason, right? So, why am I playing the deck I'm playing? Why is my, you know, how do I expect this to line up? What do I expect other people to play? What do I hope to play against? What do I hope not to play against? Just that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just trying to be, like, thinking about the metagame. Is that what you're trying to get at?
Positioning and just sort of thinking through what I could possibly play against. It doesn't, not necessarily like straight positioning, especially for something like a PPTQ where it's both a little bit smaller and the player quality isn't always super high. Yeah. I worry less about positioning probably versus just being comfortable with what I'm playing.
Mm-hmm.
I've definitely won PPTQs in the past with some pretty bad decks.
Black Red Eldrazi. I'll never forget hearing you win. I remember that's before I knew you guys, and I listened, and I was like, Michael's a master. Just stone cold, best player
no,
in
the I mean, the deck was, like, kind of bad, but it was playing Walking Ballista and Walking Ballista Temple, a.k.a. Ruins of Oren Reef. So it had a really good Four Color Saheeli matchup, yeah. I mean, but I didn't play that deck because I thought it was the best. I played it because I thought it was fun.
Yeah, no, that's definitely, you know, maybe not the best preparation, but, you know, it's good to be honest with the listeners. We don't want to lie to them. One thing that, you know, when I'm thinking about preparation for PBDQ, and, you know, you're a silver pro, so you don't have to play PBDQs like lowly scum like me over here, but when I'm thinking about a PBDQ, one of the things I'm really thinking about is, like, I try to think about what other people are going to play, and I spend a lot of time thinking about, like, all right, what are the players I think are going to do well at the PBDQ? Because I feel like if you're really great
right.
in your PBDQs, you kind of know everyone that's going to be there.
Right. You know people who are going to be there, and you know what they're playing, and you know who you can beat even if they're playing a deck that's a bad matchup
yeah.
versus who you have to beat with preparation and, like, metagaming a little bit because they're as good or better than you. So that was definitely true. Like, when I won with that red-black Eldrazi deck, it was terrible against Mardu Vehicles, but pretty much everyone who was consistently playing Mardu Vehicles had already qualified that season. So, you know, like, I knew at the PPTQ I played it at in particular, there was likely to be very little Mardu Vehicles, and more importantly, very little Mardu Vehicles in the hands of really good players.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt like it maybe wasn't as important in that event that I play something with a good Mardu matchup, despite Mardu probably being the best deck in that format.
Yeah, second best deck to Four Color Cat. I agree. No.
It was close, at least. Yeah, I mean, it was a contentious matchup at the time.
Those were the only two real decks in the format. You know, here or there.
Yeah.
It doesn't really matter. That's an old format. Who cares about that? But, Michael, do you find, you know, this is deviating a little bit here from our notes, but when it comes to preparation... Do you find that a lot of times the people in Utah, do they not switch decks a lot? Do they kind of, like, ride the course?
some people don't have the capability of switching decks a lot. I mean, either money-wise or they just don't feel comfortable switching decks a lot. And mm-hmm. I think that, like, either way, there's a lot of value in just being good with what you have. Like, whether it's a comfort level thing or not wanting to buy new cards thing or whatever, I think that just, like, updating your sideboard and, more importantly, making sure that you have plans for matchups. Like, when I play against this, how do I want a sideboard? Why do I want a sideboard this way? Why, you know, on the play, should I be doing things differently than on the draw? I think just, like, actually spending time thinking about the minutiae of the game goes a long ways, even if your deck list isn't perfect.
Yeah. I like that a lot. It makes a lot of sense to me. So, do you ever feel like you over-prepare for PPDQs?
I guess what I don't think there's really such a thing as being overprepared, but I guess what I would say with sort of relation to this is that although you can't be overprepared, you can sort of be underprepared by trying too much to pick the right deck versus just focusing on preparation with the deck you pick.
You mean like learning the matchups, having the plan, everything like that?
Yeah, I think just like really, especially at like slightly smaller events where you're not trying to, you know, win a 2,000 person tournament or whatever, you're trying to win a 30 to 40 to 50 person tournament, like being proficient with your deck is a lot more important than your deck being perfect.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. On the lines of over preparation, do you ever feel like you can get dangerous? You know, you talk about how you're spending so much time picking a deck. Do you feel like you can level yourself pretty easily at a PPDQ?
I think you can do that. What do you think?
I think, so a lot of it depends on the people in your area, right? So I'm gonna speak with my area since that's the one I'm comfortable with. A portion of the people that I expect to do well pay really close attention to Magic Online and what's doing well in circuits and game podcasts and the great people at Constructive Criticism. And, you know, they really focus in on, you know, subtle plug, but they focus in on what's the best deck. And sometimes I feel like they'll go in on that and they're over prepare for that. So what that means is, like, let's just say this week was the week of the PPDQ, right? They'd be looking at Blue Red Godfarer's Gift and they would be like, okay, well, I gotta make sure I have four Braids main deck. You know, whether that's right or wrong, right, in the big picture things, they'll kind of see that and knee jerk, some of them will. And then other people will just default to playing the best deck every time.
Right. So on the flip side, you probably also have people who just play decks that, like, aren't really playable. Like, whenever I play locally, there are a bunch of people playing, like, various blue-white approach decks, always. Or, like, blue-white cycling. And, you know, these are decks that have existed for, like, over a year at this point and have literally never at any point in their life cycle been playable, let alone good. And people still play them. And, like, there's nothing wrong with playing what you like, but knowing that, you know, like, these five people or whatever are always going to be playing this deck no matter what,
really,
like, is the kind of thing you can't really do at, like, a Grand Prix level, but you can do a lot at the PPTQ level. And it definitely informs what decision you should make because, you know, no matter how you feel, if some of the best players in your area, like, you want to win the matches presented to you. You don't want to lecture them after the match that their deck choice is bad.
You don't want to be, you don't want to be that guy who's right. Saying you're playing the unplayable deck. Nice cycling deck.
Well, I mean, I think that, like, obviously I don't think those decks are good, but at the same time, if you're playing against blue-white cycling, and you know you're going to be playing against blue-white cycling, and you pick a deck that's bad against blue-white cycling, it's pretty hard to then, at the end of the event, complain that, you know, your opponents were playing blue-white cycling.
Yeah. I definitely feel that. I have people in my area that play Sun and cycling and Bant approach regardless. And I feel like because of that, I always have Negate in my sideboard.
Sure. And I think just being prepared for what you know you'll see makes a lot of sense. And it's the same reason why I think just like picking up the deck of the week, it's fine if you like it, but I don't think that like switching decks to switch decks necessarily gives you a better chance.
How much do you think, and this is like, you know, not something we had pre-written out before, but I'm just kind of off the cuff here. How much do you think matters more about just being good at Magic? Do you know what I mean? Like just being tight and proficient, knowing your game plan, etc., versus like having a good deck? Like, how much do you think those weigh in? Because obviously you want a good deck, but, like, do you get what I'm feeling? You feel what I'm saying?
So, yeah, what I would say is this. When you're playing against someone much worse than you, it, like, guess what percentage you are to win. It's probably, like, 70-30 to 80-20, something in that range. Right? Just because, like, they're going to make mistakes in mulliganing and sequencing and their approach in the matchup and sideboarding and, you know, it's like every decision point in the game is costing them percentage points or giving you percentage points. Right?
Yep.
At the same time, if their deck is favored against you, you know, maybe you're starting at, like, a 60-40 or a 40-60 matchup, rather, or something like that. So, I think that having better decks... Having the better deck matters more the closer the players are in ability, because a lot of what you, like, there's nothing you can do to make your opponent really play worse, right? Yeah. Like, at some point, you sort of cancel each other out in terms of, you know, neither of you are just going to, like, keep one landers on seven on the play. Neither of you are going to,
maybe
you know.
Maybe you wouldn't, but...
Sure, well...
I'm just joking.
It doesn't... Right, but just, like, generically, right? Like, none of you are going to do things that dramatically lower your win percentage that are unforced. So, I think the better the players you're playing against are, the more it matters what you're playing. So, as you get later in these events, like, it's why, like, you can basically top 8 with anything, but sometimes to actually win, it really helps to, you know, be playing something that's, like, a little bit less nonsensical.
Yeah. I definitely agree with that statement where, like, if you're like, have a good chance of winning that PBDQ, and you know what I mean? Like, you're, like, one of the players that's going to, like, have a lion's share to win it.
Sure.
You can get to top 8 with almost anything. You know, if Michael plays his Black Red Eldrazi deck, he's going to get there. But having, you know, maybe he played actual Mardu vehicles, he would have had a slightly higher percentage chance to actually win it.
Yeah, right,
yeah,
I mean,
but you would have better odds. Yeah.
That's probably true, right? Like, I think that at the same time, you know your metagame, and you know some players really struggle if they don't have, like, a really good idea of every card in your deck, and don't have, like, really rigid sideboard guides to lean on, don't have really, like, some people really require a lot of reps in a matchup to understand what's happening.
Yeah.
So you can sort of abuse an advantage in, like, just information, like a disparity in information level, right? If you're playing something that your opponent doesn't really know or understand, you can leverage that into an advantage as well.
Do you feel like that happened with the blue-red Godfarer's Gift this weekend for you guys at all?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely had a couple of opponents who had very clearly never played against it before and, like, tapped out thinking that I wouldn't be able to get 6 creatures in the graveyard. And, you know, like, went, like, Walking Ballista for 0, Fanatical Firebrand, ping my own Champion of Wits, kill you, or whatever.
I was just kind of curious about that.
Yeah, and I think...
very true.
Yeah, like, I think that that's definitely... But at the same time, when you're playing against, you know, Series. Someone great, they're a lot better at... Even when they haven't necessarily played the matchup a bunch of times, they're a lot better at, like, envisioning different scenarios.
Yeah.
So, I think Sam Black made top 8, or maybe even top 4, of the Legacy portion with lands, having never played a game before with lands.
Oh, I didn't know that. He never played lands before?
Yeah, he borrowed it before the event and had 0 games.
Wow. I just kind of felt like that was the kind of deck he would play in Legacy. But that kind of speaks to what you're talking about right now, right?
Right, right,
like,
exactly.
He's really good at those kind of decks. He's really good at setting up those situations. Legacy is a format all about, you know, knowledge and execution. And he knew a lot of Legacy decks, and even though he hadn't played the matchups, he was able to figure it out. That's really awesome. Actually, I didn't know that at all.
Yeah, that's really... And, like, I guess that sort of speaks to, you know... Do you think that he played lands because he thought it was the absolute best choice for him? Maybe, or maybe he just thought lands was cool and wanted to play it.
Yeah, it's like, oh, this is a Sam deck. I'm going to play this. I feel Sam Black more than a lot of pros does that, but that's neither here.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like what makes you happy, right?
Yeah, that's
true. Maximizing your win percentage at the, you know, at the expense of never playing, at the expense of sometimes just not playing what you would rather be playing. You know, is that worth it to you? That's always sort of a question that you have to ask as you're trying to play events competitively.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that's really true of PBDQs too, where we talk about, like, you know, the better players at the shop or your area, blah, blah, blah. And, like, if you're one of the better players but you're miserable, you're not going to play as tight because you just don't want to be playing the deck.
Right, and I think that ultimately, like, you know, I would rather play something I like 99% of the time than something I think is the best.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk about deck lists. So when picking your 75 cards, Michael, do you like to do the thing, because I think it's called elephant deck building, where you just build a whole 75 and then you kind of put the cards you won the sideboard into the sideboard to figure out your construction. How do you go about picking your 75 and building it, etc.?
So, I mean, I think that works better with, like, mid-rangey decks. That works better the less linear your deck is, right? What I would say is that in terms of building a cohesive 75, I mostly make sure that I have, like, the same amounts of ins and outs in matchups.
Okay, so you, like, think about your sideboarding plan ahead of time. Like, if I was playing against mono-red this round, what would I take out? And make sure you don't have too many cards to bring in?
But yeah, I mean, if you only have 6 cards you want to cut and you have 10 cards you want to side in, it's likely that some of those slots could better be used elsewhere, or maybe that some of the cards that you haven't been boarding out are worse than you think, if the matchup is still bad or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think that just trying to think about your deck cohesively and, like, over the course of an event, what do I expect to play against? In these matchups, what cards are bad? Are there any cards that are, you know, consistently getting boarded out? Should this card be in my deck? Are there any sideboard cards that are getting boarded in? Should this card be in my main deck? You know, are there cards I can play that overlap, right? Like, you know, what gets boarded in multiple matchups? So maybe I can play more of those and less of some narrower cards, right? And not that you necessarily want to do that, but just, like, understanding what playing different sideboard configurations allows your deck to look like in sideboarded games.
Yeah, I like that. So speaking along those lines, how often do you find yourself doing stuff like, well, I know there's going to be a lot of mono-red players, mono-red's really popular right now, I'm just going to play this, you know, let's say Death Gorge Scavenger main deck over this other card because I think there's going to be a lot of people on this deck?
I think that's, like, a much more acceptable thing to do in smaller events like a PPTQ, because you just can predict with so much more accuracy exactly what the metagame will be. Like, a lot of the time, you know, if there are, like, 35 players and a lot of them are the same week to week, you just literally know what people have available to them.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about doing that kind of stuff? Because I know some people think that's, like, there are certain people that think you should play the deck list that you would play at a Grand Prix. And what, like, you know what I mean?
I don't really think that makes any sense. Like, I mean, I get that, like, you know, saying, oh, I'm great because I beat Mono Red with my 4 main deck Chandra's Defeats is like, well, yeah, but I mean, if you're going to play in a field of all Mono Red,
you would be great.
You'd be insane not to, right? I mean, I get the idea. Mm-hmm. And what I would say is that the data that you're generating maybe isn't applicable to other events if you're playing kind of, like, pre-sideboarded or really heavily contorted versions of these decks. You know, you can't necessarily apply, if you're playing Grixis Energy with, you know, but you cut all the Magma Sprays for Chandra's Defeats and, or, you know, you cut, I don't know, you're playing 4 Chandra's Defeats in your main deck somehow.
Yeah. Or even you probably, like, that's a lot. Yeah.
Whatever, I mean, whatever number it is, mm-hmm. You probably can't broadly apply what you learn from an event where you're playing such a slanted deck list towards matchups in general. But at the same time, I mean, if you're playing a PPTQ to win it, I certainly don't think that, like, metagaming is something you're, like, not allowed to do.
Yeah.
Right? Just, like, if you know what your opponent is playing, don't keep a hand that's bad in the matchup because, you know, it's...
Yeah, it's like, oh, right. If I was in the dark against a random person, I wouldn't know you're going to play mono red.
Right, exactly. Exactly, right.
Yeah. Yeah, the thing you do in testing sometimes that you don't do when you know at an event.
Right, so in testing, I'm obviously trying not to keep slanted hands because I know what my opponent is playing because it hurts the testing.
Yep.
In an event, I'm trying to win the match. And, like, for example, my round 9 opponent, I had seen him the day before playing, I knew we were going to be playing the mirror. And he did not, so I just mulliganed for a hand that fast comboed and did nothing else, and won game 1 very easily.
Yeah, which looks right. like a crazy thing, but because you had that.
Well, my hand would have been bad in the dark, but it wasn't in the dark.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, what I meant was more like if someone was watching and didn't know that you knew that, they're like, why is Michael Mulliganing this?
Sure, my 7 was perfectly fine. It just, I don't think it made a lot of sense for the matchup I knew I was playing. And I think that, like, applying that same kind of thinking to metagaming at a local event makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's fine. Like, I think a lot of times you know where you stand in your PPTQ scene, and you kind of know what you need to beat and, like, what the major archetype is going to be. And I don't think there's anything wrong with being like, yeah, I'm going to play 4 Shadow Defeats in my sideboard this weekend because I know there's going to be, like, 17 red players. And
right.
they're going to get yep. punished. Yeah.
Yep, I totally agree.
I also think that's one of the fun parts of Magic. You know, it happens on a bigger scale when you go to bigger events and you play Magic Online. But it's pretty fun to be like, all right, this weekend I'm going in for the red players. Even though you can't really apply it to the bigger events, it's nice to, like, make a call and get rewarded for it.
Definitely. I mean, I think you can often do that in more macro ways at larger events, but probably not in the, you know...
The PPTQ.
Yeah, well, probably not in the kind of micro ways you can at a PPTQ.
I feel you there. So what do you think about fun ofs and just trying out weird cards at PPTQs?
I mean, I think ultimately you should play what you want to play.
Okay.
Like... It's hard to say, like, I'm not generally happy playing cards that I know are bad, mm-hmm. but when I say I'm not happy, I literally mean me personally, I am not happy. Like, you know, if you want to play a Galta or, you know, whatever it is you like, knock yourself out, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, like, that's like a very, like, I don't mean that... I feel like I got the question to you the wrong way. I don't mean how do you feel about it, like, if I was asking you to, like, talk about it. I mean, if your goal is to win the PBDQ, you think it's valuable to have one-ofs and fun-ofs that are different than the stock deck list. So let's take Green-Red Monsters, for example.
Sure, right? sure. Instead like playing a Samoot.
Yeah, right. Playing a Samoot is a card that's, like, you combine that with any of your creatures, basically. That is
sure.
a huge
Sure, like, we
thing.
Cut the 4th Regisaur Alpha for a Samoot or something. Yeah, so yeah. I think that often the stock deck lists are pretty optimal, but I do also think that the worse the players you're playing against, the more they lean on their knowledge of deck lists. Like, there's a certain level where it won't work, right? If your opponent is bad enough, they won't even know what the deck list you're trying to, like, imitate is.
Gotcha.
Right? They you're just literally playing a worse card, and they'll never play around it, but they would never play around anything. So
it doesn't matter.
You know,
yeah.
It's kind of sixes. But there are a lot of players where when things change a little bit, they don't adapt very well. And I think that if you think your metagame features a lot of those players, you could do things like that and maybe get rewarded for it. I think, in general, playing different things to be different is probably not a winning strategy, but playing different things for a specific reason, you know, if you think it's good, knock yourself out.
Yeah, I would say being different for different sake is just bad. I mean, I don't think that's a very good
sure.
thing in Magic. But I think, like, being different for the sake of metagaming, even if it's just kind of like we talked about with the Chandra's Defeat main deck, right? If the decision's informed and it's, you know, it makes sense when you really think about the tournament you're going to, I think that's fine.
Yeah, it certainly can.
Yeah. So, speaking of all this stuff, one thing we haven't really talked about is picking your removal and picking the kind of threats you're going to play. So does the meta, like, when you're going to PBDQ, we keep talking about mono red, did you ever skew more towards beating those kind of decks? Like, when you were playing during Sahila Cat, you talk about how you're playing Warren Reef Walking Ballista combo. So, was that a thing you did a lot where you're like, Michael's trying not to laugh here, did you, like, aim towards certain decks to have better removal for those decks?
I think that tilting your removal and deck selection and really everything else towards what you expect the better players in the room to be playing makes a lot of sense. If we just kind of go back to, when you're playing against people who are substantially worse than you, you're likely to win a lot of games on things that are more like Magic fundamentals and less like deck list and deck choice specifics. Mm-hmm. And I think that as you become just a better Magic player in general, you'll likely notice that your win rate against relatively poor players anytime you're playing like something kind of mid-rangey or anything with unpolarized matchups is just very, very good. So I think that when you're thinking about threats and answers, like, at larger events, I'm always a little bit nervous to play reactive decks just because there's so much to plan for. But when you're looking at a smaller metagame, I'm more comfortable playing a more reactive deck just because you have a way better chance at actually picking the correct answers. Then you do it like a Grand Prix level where you're liable to play some kind of narrow cards and really get punished for it.
Yeah. You know, that's something we talk about, how, like, when a format, you know, I would say this is a healthy standard format, right? There's maybe a little bit too much scare ground, a little bit too much hazard, but for the most part, there's a lot of different decks you can play, a lot of different strategies. It's really hard to play a deck like blue-black control when the threats and are so diverse, and the answers, you know, you really have to pick and choose the battles. When you play a format like Zaheeli Cat Mardu, it's much easier to kind of pick the removal that you need and play it at a bigger event. Whether it's a good choice or not doesn't really matter, but you can actually kind of get a better feel for it. How do you feel?
Right, so one of the things that'll happen is at bigger events, just the decks that are best will rise to the top because people will find reasons to play other things. Like, people still play Constrictor, people still play control decks in those metagames. And what generally happens is the people playing other decks slant their decks very heavily against Saheeli and Mardu or whatever, but sometimes they play against... They're going to lose some percentage of these matches regardless, just because their decks are worse. And sometimes they play against, you know, either great players, or they play against decks that they weren't really expecting, and their sort of metagamed piles just are going to take a couple of losses. In a smaller event, I think you're much more likely to win with a deck like, you know, Red Black Eldrazi or whatever kind of nonsense you feel like playing, because you just aren't going to have to play like 15 rounds.
Yeah, that's
right. Like, you just, there's like playing a deck that has some really bad matchups is much less, it's a lot less hard to swallow when you're just not playing quite so many rounds.
Makes a lot of sense. Well, I hope this training grounds was interesting and helpful for everyone out there. I thought it was very fun, and I got to hear some cool thoughts from Michael. You know, Michael's leveled up beyond the PBDQ grind, but that
for the moment, yeah. I mean,
well, aren't you locked?
Never too far away. Yeah, I mean, for next year as well. But
okay, and next year's one where it starts rotating too. So at any moment, you could just fall off that train.
That's true. That's true. I could become wood level pro Michael Hinderocker.
Yeah, never forget.
You never know.
Back in the good days. But, I think that was a good episode. If you like this episode and you like the show and you feel like you want to give back, feel free to go to patreon.com/CCMTG. There's a lot of different levels. Whatever you feel comfortable donating, we appreciate. It goes right back into the show. I'm not sure what the next goal is, but you can go on there and see it. And we like to keep everything visible so you can know where we're at with all that kind of stuff. But if you don't feel like you can give back to the show right now because of life or whatever, you just can't afford it, that's fine. Show will always be free. We thank you just for listening. You can also check out our sponsors at The Mana Base once again. You know, you can see the visual format of this. You can see Michael trying not to laugh when I bring up Auron Reef Ballista combo. You can see me, you know, trying not to laugh when he says funny stuff. But yeah, no, you can check them out too, and you always check out Oasis Games again. So Michael, let's move on to hashtag Would That Be Good. Hashtag Would That Be Good is our Twitter outreach program. If you tweet it, Mason will read it. And I'm not actually ready for that, so I was hoping you would say something sassy while
okay.
I'm out there.
I found it.
Oh, perfect.
Matthew tweets, introduced my daughters to the joys of Magic the Gathering for the first time. First steps into a larger world, hashtag would that be good.
That's awesome.
Yeah, sweet. I like just getting to hang out with your family and play games and...
I might be biased in the whole Magic is good thing. Not sure. But, that sounds like a great time.
Yeah.
Jed Jacobson tweets, at CCMTG, someone get Danny a mic so you can understand him on. Hashtag always proving, hashtag would that be good.
I mean, I hang out with Danny relatively frequently, and I just can never understand him. So, like, I mean, I can hear what he says. It just sometimes, you know.
It's like, why are you saying this?
Sometimes it just gets out of control.
Yeah, I there's a lot going on with Danny in the mic situation. No one's happy about it, listeners. No one's excited. No one's happy. I'm not. Danny's not. Spencer's definitely not. Let's move on. Ben Vasco.
It may be time to play Snake again in Standard. Somehow this tweet already feels old.
It didn't age well. You know, you see people tweet like, I'm going to top it the classic, and they do it, and they retweet it, and they're like, this aged well. Not so well, Ben.
It's just like the opposite, yeah.
Yep. Spencer tweets, listener asked me about Valakut. Hashtag, would that be good? Hashtag, best day.
Spencer, I'm not gonna read the conversation because it's like literally a conversation about Valakut. It's not that exciting.
Yeah, Michael, what's your hot take on Valakut? Go.
That it's cold.
Oh,
meaning
you're saying
bad.
It's bad. Yeah, I like it. I like that ice cold take. Water.
I mean, that's not really a hot take. Like, I feel like I have thought that about that deck for almost eternity at this point.
Yeah, I know. We've definitely had conversations where you definitely didn't seem excited about me playing.
I mean, it's like, it's not even that. I both don't think it's good, but it's also not my speed. So it's not the kind of deck that if it's like kind of okay, I would think was good.
Yeah. All right. I need your hot take on Hollow One. Go. You weren't here last week for the conversation.
I like Hollow One. Hollow One's a good sign.
I got.
It's also
right
really
there.
Good.
Yeah. Ooh, I love it. All right. I win this war, Spencer. You can't respond because you're not here. Spencer Truth, hashtag, would that be good? So Matthew King, friend of Michael Hinderocker in the show, he tweets at Ray-Ban at Casey. Ray-Ban sunglasses, anniversary special edition, each for only $21.99, limited time only purchase. And Casey says sick. And that's just a good deal.
Yeah, we found out that Matt's Twitter was hacked to sell Ray-Bans. And man, it was great.
Yeah, he tweeted it at me, and I was like, I feel like this is either like a callback to the joke when it all started where his account got hacked again. Now I know. Spencer tweets, streaming my RPTQ on delay, and then hashtag would that be good, PT Dom, hashtag would that be good. It didn't go so well for Spencer and I this weekend at our RPTQs, so.
No, it looked like Spencer did, was like 2-2.
He 2-2 dropped.
Yeah, and his deck was okay, but not spectacular.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to do well with that kind of thing. Jared Poole tweets, just beat a Silver Level Pro for the first time ever to end up going 5-1. His matchup is really poor against my deck, so definitely wasn't a skill difference win, haha, but still counts as a W, hashtag would that be good. First off, it does still count. Second off, way to outpick him in deck selection. Way to go.
Yeah, that's like my only good skill, so, you know, I really give myself a lot of props for that. Because my ability to play is sometimes kind of depressing. Yeah.
All right. Jared Poole tweets, 6-1 so far at GP Seattle. I'm going to be making day 2 for the first time. Congrats. Only my second GP. Just got to win one more round of the day. Hashtag would that be good. That's awesome.
Anything? Yeah, so he ended 6-2 on day 1.
Yay.
Which is pretty good. Nice to make your first day 2. And then Andrew tweets a picture of his match slip against you.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So round 2, I get paired against that guy from hashtag would that be good, Andrew Elliott. And, you know, my deck is what you might call a hot pile. Andrew's deck was a green-red deck with Carnage Tyrant. The one redeeming factor in my pool, Michael, is I had a lot of fixing and a lot of good removal. Guess what's not very good against Carnage Tyrant?
Either of those.
Both, correct. I beat it, and then he played that Naya Dino thingy that buys back the dinosaur.
Oh, he played Atsakan Seer.
Yeah, and then he played it, and Squire's Devotion did, and I was like, I can't win, that's not fair.
Why would you Squire his Devotion to Carnage Tyrant? That's just such a rub-in.
You gotta get the 8 life.
Especially the second Carnage Tyrant of the same game.
Yeah.
It's just mean. Not gonna have any friends if you keep doing that.
I know, it won't help your case. Ben Vasco tweets, hashtag, would that be good? And I was tweeting about my game day, or the, what's it called, store championship?
Sure.
My store championship, my LGS, the Game Cave, did a cool thing where if you won with an event deck, Well, I'm sorry, the Challenger deck. I'm getting all the names wrong. If you wanted the Challenger deck, you got a box of cons. And guess what I got over here, Michael? I got a box of cons.
Did you open it yet?
No, I'm going to do some drafts with friends later in the
Sweet.
Week.
So, yeah, cons is a fun format. Last time I drafted cons, though, it was in Russian. And I wasn't playing during cons, so both me and Corey were trying to draft removal spells based on the picture.
Powerful.
It was... I was good at drafting removal spells. He was good at drafting, like, Stone Rains and Disenchants. So... It was a good time.
Oh, man. I'm going to have to look at the art next time we draft to see that. Yeah, cons is my favorite limited format. And
I knew Sandblast was in the format, so I mostly had a lot of Sandblast, and he had a lot of, like, naturalize effects. It was great.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Jared Poole tweets about his record somewhere. He said, 8-4, had the worst best mode of the GP where I legend ruled my Galta after having two Register Alphas on board, still won that turn, but it was the most embarrassing funny moment ever. Just got too excited, haha.
Yeah, I did the same thing. I Yamwing Chun'd myself and forgot to play the second-to-last card in my hand before I went to combat, so I still killed my opponent by a lot, but it would have been by like 100 more if I had been able to attack with the Hazoret like all three times.
Jared Poole tweets, just met Magic Mike MTG, and his voice is as golden as it is on CCMTG, albeit shorter than I expected. Hashtag, would that be good?
Yeah, I'm, like, not really... I mean, I'm not, like, short, but I'm not tall either.
I was going to say, I feel like you're average height.
Very average.
What's your height?
I am, I think, a little over 5'10".
I was going to say, yeah, I feel like you're slightly shorter or my height, and I'm, like, just at 6. I'm like 6 1/4, so.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'm at like 5'10 1/4 to 1/2 or something like that. But my girlfriend is very short, and it makes me look taller if you only see me on Facebook.
Oh, yeah, that is, yeah.
Yeah.
You look really tall in your profile picture.
Yeah, I mean, that's because she's 5 feet tall, so.
That's true, yeah.
Yeah, no, I know I'm average height because I literally never think about my height.
Yep, there you go.
right? It's just like I never feel tall or short.
Yeah,
so.
You're right in the middle. I like it. Spencer tweets, hashtag, would that be good? And this is retweeting Jared going 10-4 game, my first pro point. I'm super happy about that. Still another round to play, so got to stay sharp. Always improving. Now, I don't think Jared won his next round. And my
I think he won lost the last one, but,
oh, yeah,
you know.
Yeah. I was going to say he didn't tweet about it, but he did. That's normally a good way to know if someone won or they lost the last round. It's like, they're 10-4. What happened? They weren't
happy. this is like all my tweets about pro tours ever.
Yeah.
Which is,
he never tweets. Sky goes, how do we fit Lingering Souls into Hollow One? I don't know, man. Mike, what do you think about that? Yeah, don't.
We don't. We don't need it. That's not, like, we're trying to play 4-4s. 1-1s do not make the cut.
Yeah, they're sweet with your cathartic, or you're not cathartic, with your lootings and inquiries and lores, but not.
So, the secret is that it's not actually that good with, like, you'd have to actually play Mardu mana for that to be a thing,
yeah.
Because it's actually not good. It's specifically not good with Goblin Lore or Burning Inquiry, because it's going to end up keep getting stuck in your hand. It's not going to go into your graveyard nearly as much as you want it to.
Wait, you don't just get to pick the card you put in your graveyard?
Well, I mean...
I feel like I do every time.
When you're high-rolling, it feels like it, but yeah, it doesn't quite work that way.
Huh. I just always get...
Yeah, that's not working that well for me.
You should try doing that. It makes the deck a lot better. Spencer very rudely tweets at Mason Clark, hashtag fixed Mason's graduation, hashtag would that be good, and then it's a picture of my high school, and I graduated in 2012, and I was driving by there, and I had some extra time today, so I hopped in to go say hi to a few teachers because I hadn't seen them in, I guess, 5 years now. I remember visiting 2013, so it's been a long time, and I took the picture. I don't know if your high school did this. I went to a private school, so it's probably different, but there's a picture of every class that graduates on the wall. I took a picture of mine and then zoomed in on me and tweeted them.
Nah, my graduating class is like 1,000.
Oh, yeah, that's one of those white Nashville things where I'm like, there's 100 people in my class, barely. We're the biggest class in like 70 years. But, so Spencer likes to think that I'm 15, and he sent a series of tweets across all my social media. He reposted them everywhere, thinking... The first one was funny. I'll give him that. He's like, why did they do this before you guys actually graduated? Implying that I'm not, you know, an old man or whatever. And then he just kept going and going. And then he eventually very poorly photoshopped my 2012 to a 2021.
It actually, you can still see the one, so yeah. It's actually, you don't graduate for like 18,000 years.
Yeah, it's a long time.
No, it's an extra digit. It's going to be a minute.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's a while. So, yeah, so Spencer.
It's 2121. Yeah.
You played yourself. But thank you, everyone, for listening. I had a great time filling in for Spencer. Spencer was on a business trip, and he is currently in the sky flying back to Utah. But he will be here next week. And I think next week, Michael, is the Dominaria preview show. I think we're getting
to couldn't tell you.
Yeah, that's exciting. I can't wait for all your hot takes on Karn Silver Golem.
Oh, boy.
Well, I guess it's Scion of Urza now, but whatever. That's next week's show. I've got a lot of pictures to grab. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we will see you all next week.
See ya.